Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00043. Recorded on April 27, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Gray Area. Part 2. Chapter 43. Note,
the opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
So the American dream is, it's the suburbs, right? Like I keep saying, the American dream is the suburban lifestyle. It's the flight out of the city, right? Out of urban America into suburban America. That's your American dream. But see, the American dream is different. That's what the American dream is. The Texas dream is something different than that. The Texas dream is actually fleeing the city and fleeing the suburbs and going out to the country to get that rural lifestyle. That's the Texas dream. Right? So they're two different fucking things, right? The idea here is that you're stuck in the city, you're stuck in the suburbs, and you're working and working and working to that day when you can get the fuck out of all this and leave it behind. And the only direction is out, and out there is rural America, right? That's the Texas dream, a dream of cattle and cattle ranches, farms and forests, deserts, desert sunsets, wild rivers, big skies and great adventure, right? That's the Texas dream. But, I mean, if you're seeking the American dream, you will obviously you obviously find the American dream in Texas. That ain't the Texas dream. It is the American dream, and it is in Texas. You can do it. You can do it because it's all around me. Everywhere I go, you know, I'm kind of stuck in it. Post-Harlan is the American dream in Texas. Now, I say that as a lead-in to a documentary I happened to see within the past week or so. I forget exactly which day. I was looking for something else. Once upon a time, I saw this document. Oh, it was a documentary, but it was like a full, like a feature length, like an hour and a half, maybe. A documentary that involved anarchists, an anarchist group in Plano, Texas. Plano, Texas is one of these post-Harlan DFW, they call it a city, it's a suburb, right here, right down the street, right? Right in the heart of it all. It's like you have the city of Dallas, and then north of that you got Plano, right? So it touches Dallas. It touches North Dallas. It's like the eventual extension of North Dallas. And I'll probably get into that eventually, too. But there was this documentary involving an anarchist group, you know, young group of anarchist people, young guys, young girls, who lived in Plano. And for some reason, that flashed through my mind. You know, it's, you have a brain in your skull. You know how memories just kind of come at you out of nowhere? Something you smell, something you see, a color, maybe something somebody wear, maybe a tone of voice, an accent somebody has. Something reminded me of this. And I went on YouTube and started to seek it out. I couldn't find it, but I found something that I thought might have been it, except for the fact that it was only 30 minutes long. It's a documentary that was a PBS documentary released in the year 2000 called, and I quote, Plano, Texas, : A Cultural Study of Suburbia. Plano, Texas, A Cultural Study of Suburbia. And again, it was PBS from 2000, so I click on the link and I check it out. It was only a half an hour long, which was a red flag to me, telling me that that's probably not what I'm hoping it is. And it wasn't. It was close. You know, a lot of the stuff was on the same lines, but it was not the same documentary, not the same movie that I was intending to find. I'm going to keep on looking for that thing. But in the meanwhile, I watched this. And this was really a presentation that was describing what would be obviously an unexpected dynamic that occurred between the American dream, as we call it, and then the American nightmare that grew out of it. The American dream becomes an American nightmare. The idea speaks to the tragic events that befell the community of Plano, Texas, and surrounding areas through the 1980s, 1990s, and even to this very day, right? The documentary spoke of the implementation of planned communities of suburban subdevelopments north of the city of Dallas into the city of Plano, which at the time was no city. The actual old town village or city of Plano sits right on the Central Expressway, right? Highway 75, running northward out of Dallas, northeast out of Dallas. And it's really a small corner of the town. There's not a whole lot to it. A handful of blocks make up that area. And the original growth around that village would be east of that. So East Plano, across to the west of the Central Expressway, you have what is the western half of Plano, the western side, that runs westward all the way out to Frisco. Plano is very large. But that area at the time, late 70s, 1980, early 80s, was all ranches and farms and nothing else. It was wide open country. You got to the end of Dallas, and then there was nothing until you got to McKinney. Now, McKinney is the county seat of Collin County, so it always has some kind of economy wrapped around its county functions, including justice, law enforcement, community college, right? So every county's got its county seat. Every county seat has some kind of economic substance to be the town or small city that it is. And McKinney was that on its own. But at that time, it stood apart and away from Dallas. It was really not a part of DFW. It was quite a ways away, right? It is basically in that direction, north out of Plano, which is north out of Dallas, the next town up. But since there was nothing in that section of Plano for miles around, you pretty much went from North Dallas to McKinney with open acres. Now, McKinney has grown south towards Dallas. Plano has grown north towards McKinney, and all that area is filled in. But in the late 70s, which is also the time of the beginning of the television series, the very famous, internationally famous, what they call it, the nighttime soap opera called Dallas, right? J.R. Ewing, Who Shot J.R., the South Fork Ranch, all that stuff, right? Which I've mentioned before. That's right down the street over here, right? It's a real place. It exists. Now it is surrounded by subdevelopments, right? It's kind of funny. You got like this big operational, functional ranch in the middle of subdevelopments. Right? It's kind of surrounded just about on all sides by that. And back then, however, like I wasn't a big fan. I knew of the show. I seen a little here, a little there. It was more an adult thing, and I was more like an 11-year-old child when it came up. And it was not my bag at that age. I would probably watch it now if I could find somewhere to watch it. And I should put that on my fucking bucket list of things to do here. But I did see it. It was so popular. Everybody saw a little of it. You know, everybody didn't know who J.R. Ewing was. It was kind of a big, it was not kind of, it was a big fucking deal. It was a cultural phenomenon at the time, in that late 70s, early 80s. And I believe it maintained its television presence all the way through the 80s, right? It went through some changes and shit like that, but all the shows do. Anyhow, in the opening credits, I remember, you know, I had an impression when I came to this area initially of what life around the South Fork Ranch would be like. And I kind of remember like aerial footage, right, probably from a helicopter over, you know, high above the South Fork Ranch. And it would show the panorama of everything around it, and there was nothing. It was just all fields as far as you could see, like in all directions. And it's not that way anymore, right? It ain't that way anymore. But see, back in, and here's the story as it goes in the documentary about Plano and suburbia and this American dream becoming an American nightmare, at least for some people. At that time, the change began. They started to fill in all of that territory, right, with subdevelopments, all the housing, suburbia, right? Suburbia took over what was rural and agricultural. So as the documentary explains, right, the documentary, again, called Plano, Texas, A Cultural Study of Suburbia, released by PBS in the year 2000, right, subdevelopments, the idea of a suburbia around Dallas was a very new thing at the time. It was designed to appeal to an upper middle class of people that worked generally in the professional sector, right? In Dallas County, just outside of Dallas, in the city of Richardson, you have had then and have now a technological sector. If you recall the corporation Texas Instruments, right? It comes out of Dallas and it has a big presence in Dallas and then over into Richardson. And back then it was probably even larger, right? Texas Instruments was a big deal back then. It's not as big of a deal now. Technology has changed so much over the years, but once upon a time. But you have, from where Texas Instruments is in the north, I guess you call it the northeast corner of the city of Dallas, where it kind of has this 635, I-635 loop, the LBJ Highway, as it's called, and then Baines-Johnson Highway, as kind of the outskirts of Dallas, right? It's a looping highway that draws a circle around Dallas. You cross out of that to the northeast, you're into Richardson, and right there at that juncture is a large Texas Instruments campus, and then from that way out, you get into this entire tech sector of all kinds of corporations. So you had, at the time, a lot of technical people that lived and worked in Dallas or just immediately around Dallas in places like Richardson that was developing as a result of the technological sector, right? And developing Plano was an appeal to people of that particular level of status, right? Upper middle class people. And what you had otherwise was city living, right? Dallas is a city and you have a big downtown. And then you have city neighborhoods, kind of similar to like what I live in. And for people like that, for people who were making good money, there wasn't really a neighborhood for that type, for that status. In North Dallas, you have an upper class area, you know, real foofy shit, right? That even like if you were director level of a corporation, you know, of a department in a corporation, and you made really good money, you did not make enough money to be neighbors with the people in North Dallas as it was. When I talk about North Dallas, North Dallas is a particular section. Closer in towards downtown are other sections that are even higher in status. But I don't mean North Dallas as a section of the city. I mean it as like the area north of downtown, the whole entire thing, which includes like the length of Hillcrest, the length of Preston, Turtle Creek, all that stuff in there. And all the different sections, all the different neighborhoods in and amongst that, around SMU, you know. You have places where the professors all lived. And give you an idea, like the status of what I call North Dallas, a section called Preston Hollow in there is where former President George W. Bush resides, right, to this day. That's where his house is. And where his house is, it's not acreage, it's not ranches, it's a fucking neighborhood. And he's got neighbors. Neighbors who are as qualified to be in that neighborhood as he is. So this just gives you an idea. When I say upper class, I mean upper class. So when you're a middle manager, a middle management level corporate professional, there really didn't seem to be a place for you to live. So opening up these subdevelopments up in Plano was appealing to that kind of person, that kind of family. So those people would move up there. They couldn't quite swing the north of downtown Dallas, North Dallas as I'm calling it, but north of that, they started putting up subdevelopments in Plano. So you were just kind of like one rung under high society in terms of status to live up there. And it was its own status thing, and it was separating you from the problems of the city that you had in general, right? Drugs and violence and shit like that, just the problems that come with too many people in one place. But also now you started to have the way the subdevelopments were put up back then initially, you had a little bit of breathing room. Houses weren't right up on top of each other. You had a yard, you know, front yard, a backyard, room on the sides, your own driveway and garage, you know, larger house, new house. But it was all done in a Texas style back in those days, right? You got your Texas type of suburbs, and now we've got the California type what we call McMansions, right? Same basic premise. You're attracting the same level of people, more or less. These would be, you know, who do I mean? Not just your technological sector, middle management, you know, director level types, but you got lawyers in their own practice. You've got business owners, small business owners, you know, people with that kind of income moving into this kind of place. So in the late 70s and early 80s, it began. And it began as an ideal, a suburban ideal, the literal American dream. Get out of the city where you were working and scraping and hoping to maybe be able to climb in status and live in the north of Dallas amongst the social elite, as it was and as it is, or be stuck down in urban conditions as you were. So you make the move out of there, and you know, it was a planned situation. Not only was it adequate housing for your level of income status, not was it only adequate housing for people with the intent on growing a family, but it was also planned in regards to schooling, right? The school system that was built in a built up in and around this idea of suburbanizing the western part of Plano, built up in a school system that was in the state of Texas was second to none, and there was a great appeal. Now everybody who's interested in creating a family and raising kids obviously is going to have the value of the schooling system high on their list of what matters to them, right? And this was top-notch. This was top-notch public education, right? Not top-notch education as a whole, but top-notch public education. And people just started moving out in droves. Let's just get to it, you know? People, what I'm trying to emphasize is the fact of the income level of the people, the types of family that were moving in, and then some of the reasons why they were making that move. Now, these reasons come into play because it became a successful model. It was a successful model. People were making that move. And one sub-development would fill up, and they would start on another one and another one, and there you had the beginning of the urban sprawl in DFW, which continues to this day, and it's incredibly, it's spread out incredibly since then, and I'm not a big fan of it. I'll just be honest with you. I'm not a big fan of it. I'm not a suburban person. I've probably said that a time or two before, but it is what it is, you know. It is the American dream. It is the American reality. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about this documentary. There is a dream and there is a reality that goes along with the dream. So all these people move out there, and you have the basic expectation of an ideal circumstance for raising families. And sadly, it turned out to be, in many cases, not exactly a dream. It was indeed a nightmare. And a nightmare is like this. For one reason or another, there became a prevalence of heroin addiction and death by misadventure and death by suicide of teenagers. Young people in the suburbs, in these quote-unquote good families, in these quote-unquote ideal circumstances, were for some reason not hacking. They were not hacking. They were not coping well with their situation. They were turning to drugs, which means they had some kind of psychological problems, which is going to go back to the environment that they live in. So it's not ideal for everybody, right? That's, you know, a lot of, you know, it not every kid was turning to drugs and evolving into heroin and devolving into suicide. But so many were, it actually became headlines, national headlines. And Plano became reputable for that sad fact. But before that came to be, Plano was known for the success of the burgeoning subdevelopment setup. And the original migration was right here out of Dallas, and then secondarily the rest of the state of Texas, and then eventually, and I mean by eventually, I don't mean too long, 2-3 years into it, right, the entire nation started moving into Plano, family by family, filling it up. Plano is a suburb. They call it, it's a, you know, city of Plano, but it's a suburb. There's no skyscrapers and shit like that. It, you know, like I said, you got the old village area, which was kind of, you know, a support town for rural interests in the rural day. It's where you would go in to buy, you know, I talked about families who bought nothing but fucking coffee and sugar and flour and did everything else on their own. This was the place you would go to buy that without going all the way down to Dallas for it, right? It was kind of like an outpost. City of Plano, it was just that. No, it's not really a city. It's a suburb of Plano, but the suburb of Plano has like 350,000 people in it. Yeah. It's humongous. A ginormous suburb, right? So, people start moving into there. It got some kind of national airplay on like 60 Minutes television show or something like that. You know, somebody did some kind of segment on Plano, Texas, and the suburbs that were growing up there outside of Dallas, and it raised national interest, and that's how you started getting a migration into this area. The jobs were here, the housing was here, the schooling was here, the opportunity was here, and here they come, right? The 1980s version of the pioneer heading into Texas. And it wasn't soon thereafter where now you started having a subculture within your suburban dream of heroin and suicide amongst your teenagers. Again, psychological problems, so environmental problems, something wrong in the environment. So you got to look at a couple of factors. A, the family first and foremost, right? When you draw the picture of the perfect family life and you're dealing with upper middle class situations, everything looks good on paper. The problem is there's problems, you know. To maintain that lifestyle, the breadwinner in the family generally is going to have a lot of demands with the job. The job is going to demand long hours, and there's going to be a commute coming and going. You're basically going to have, as it was in that time, a father who is gone most of the day. And when he finally is present, he's got really nothing left for the family. And then you end up with a weekend father. But of course, he wants to break his fucking shit, you know, break his own psychological issues from the week's work by, what, running off to the golf course for the day. Something like that. And this becomes the lifestyle of the upper middle class. This is the typical situation. And somewhere in the mix is some slutty little ladder-climbing corporate bitch that works up in flirtation into an affair with this ordinary father of four, you know, out in suburbia, and now you've got marital problems in the household, and everything starts to go to hell. Meanwhile, the people who are in the house are trapped in that situation. They're trapped in the cloud of the immorality that's going on. They're trapped in the cloud of the absence of the father figure in the household because of the workload and the commute and all that shit. The whole lifestyle, the commuter lifestyle, right? But then they're physically trapped as well, right? They're physically trapped because you need a car to do anything in the suburbs, as I mentioned earlier. Or perhaps the wife, the mother, you know, has a car, probably does. That's how it was back then. You usually had two cars in a family until the kids were grown up, and then they started getting their own too. And but the mother might have been a stay-at-home mom. She's still got to cart the kids everywhere that they got to go, or else they don't go nowhere. And if they go nowhere, what do? They stay home. And they're bored out of their fucking mind, and they make trouble. And this is kind of the landscape, you know. Inside the four walls of a suburban house. This is kind of the basic framework of what's going on an interpersonal level, and then on a geographic level. The kids, they could run out the front door, out into the street, they could run around, do whatever they want to do, but there's nothing for them to do. Because everything is a house and a yard, and a house and a yard, and a house and a yard. And they might throw up a little tiny like community park somewhere in the middle of it with a couple of rides. So what do? You go there and hang out. You know, you get enough kids there hanging out, sooner or later, the one kid who's into, you know, he smokes cigarettes and he drinks beer and he smokes weed, he's hanging out, you're hanging out, you're bored, and you just say, fuck it, pass the bone, you know, fuck it, I'll try that. And then you start to find some sense of satisfaction in a cerebral endeavors rather than going out and like grabbing the bull by the horns and living a physical and analog type of life, you know, because that's all you got. That's all you got out there as kids. You know, there's no woods to go run around in, no farm fields that you know, you can't just grab a gun and go shoot. You nowhere to go fishing, nowhere to do fucking nothing, right? Nowhere to do nothing. Some of these parks have evolved, you know, from the 90s forward to being like, instead of just little playset playgrounds, they've evolved to being like skate parks and things like that. But it doesn't change anything. It just means that when you go to the park, you go on your skateboard. But you want to go to a pizzeria, you want to go to the movie theater, you want to just go where kids hang out, you know. And then the kids that you want to hang out with, you know, you meet the kids in school, and the kids that you meet in school that you get along with, you might make like 5-10 friends, and they could live in 5 or 10 different subdevelopments, and they can all be 2 miles apart from each other. It's a, how do you get them all together? And again, this is before there were cell phones and all, and the internet and all this stuff, you know, you had to dial your house phone. Hope to get in touch with somebody. Hope that they were all available to take a fucking 2-mile hike to meet you halfway. Hope that it was worth their bother to do it. And that's the thing. It was never worth the bother. Yesterday you hung out. You just sat there until you were bored out of your fucking mind. You know? Today, it's, I don't want to do it again. But if they say, well, I got weed. All right, that changes it. That puts a level of veneer on the situation. But again, it becomes a cerebral thing. I'm just trying to draw a basic picture of the boredom that a kid experiences like during the summer months living out in suburbia. It is this way. It is that way. I hated going to school. I hated school. I was glad when the summer came. But halfway through the summer, you're like, fuck, what am I going to do? This sucks too. Now you're caught in a hamster wheel of existence where it just always sucks. And the only time I was ever happy, content, was when I was partying. So that's what becomes of these people, right? These kids in Plano in the 80s and the 90s. And to this day, they're living that lifestyle. Trapped in those confines. Existing in those familial situations. Now, not every husband is out there cheating on his wife and wife cheating on a husband. And not every household has to suffer the decline of their children into drugs and suicide. But again, I use the word prevalence. It was so prevalent that Plano became known for it. The heroin problem in Plano was a national discussion. It's evolved. I mean, it's continued on. I had to, the situation expanded beyond Plano. All of post-Arlen, all of DFW that has been overrun, encroached with urban sprawl, as they call it. These spreading suburbs. Every fucking town that's a part of it suffers these same consequences. Through all these years, heroin, it's always been some opiate thing, some addiction thing, young death, suicide, all that stuff happening in the lives of these young Texan children. You know, they are teenagers. Well, I don't know. In this society, they're teenagers. 100 years ago, they were adults. You've got to figure it all out. There's a reason why it is the way it is. And I believe this whole suburban, quote-unquote, dream is a part of that. It's a part of that. And the time is not going to permit, but I would wish to get into that a little bit deeper. But you're just going to have to do without my further psychoanalysis on the matter at that point. But the fact of the matter is, it became in DFW, starting with Plano, but then spreading to all the other suburban communities attached to it. A known heroin problem, and in fact, for lack of better description, a former stepson of mine, right? I was not exactly married to his mother, but we were living as such, you know, in sin, as they say, living in sin. Her eldest had these issues. He was one of these kids. He was one of these suburban kids. And got into the heroin, had the heroin problems. And he fought his way through. And as far as I know, never did commit suicide. You know, where I left off, he was still alive, you know. And there's a lot to that story, and it's a lot of personal shit I don't want to get into. It's a good guy. It makes me sad to think about, you know, somebody like him, very handsome, very personable, very polite, you know, real Texan kid, you know, real Texas kid for sure, in so many different ways. But with a lot of issues, a lot of psychological issues, both on his mother's side and on his father's side. He was like a person who was put together very well with all kinds of advantages, but family issues were just so terrible that he was up against it his entire childhood and into his early adulthood. If he's alive, I'm sure something's come out of him, because he's probably managed to get away from so much of that crap, you know? But I experienced what I'm talking about. I experienced what this documentary is talking about firsthand, right? The focus at the was at the time, you know, ultimately the problem with the heroin and everything that the documentary was discussing was present to the year 2000. And this young man who was in my life, he was more of like a 2010s kind of case, right? He was a kid in the 2000s, and he was a teenager in the 2010s. Well, actually, no, he was a teenager in the 2000s. That's right. He was a senior in high school when I came into his life, and that was in 2007. So yeah, he was a little bit after the documentary by a couple of years, but he fit right in with the crowd, you know? You wouldn't look at him and think heroin. You just would not. And you would not look at any of these kids and think heroin. They were not like we were back in the day. They were not any of the sordid, quote-unquote, burnouts, as I speak about so frequently. You know, the varieties of them. But they were always, or almost always, very obvious. You could pretty much tell who the people on drugs were. And it got to a point where you really don't know. You walk into a supermarket, there's young people in there. Maybe even the guy like working the checkout counter. you look at him and you, it's a kid, ordinary all-American Texas kid, right? Bang, gets knocks off from work and he boots up heroin behind a fucking dumpster. You just don't see it. Anyway, I'm getting a lot away from the point here. You know, I was getting into kind of the circumstances that lead to the problems that came up very surprisingly, right? Again, you had an ideal situation with this whole idea of the suburbs and the planned community of Plano, as it was. The nightmare that came out of it was something unexpected, but it's real. And you know what? It's not just here. I don't mean to say it's just here, but it is here, but it is everywhere, too. It is everywhere, too. Plano became known for it. I guess because it was nationalized, you know. There was a nationalization of it that drew people in from other states, and then this apparent failure, right? The social crisis that was inherent to this situation was also a national thing. How do I know that? Because PBS put out a documentary on it in 2020, right? That's national. PBS is national. So it's a matter of suburban kids, their boredom, the family situations, and accessibility to drugs. That's what I didn't mention that the documentary talked about. These kids had particular accessibility to drugs because of their status, right? As upper middle class people, their family did have money. And these people would have, these young people would have their own money. They asked, they got it. It's kind of being spoiled, you know what I mean? They had money and nothing to spend it on except for drugs, living in the suburbs. Like I said, you couldn't just go up to a pizzeria. You couldn't just go to the mall, you know, whatever. Whatever city kids could do, you couldn't just go and do. Whatever country kids could do, even though they were out in the fucking middle of nowhere, they had options, you know. Country kids, rural kids, have a lot of shit that they can go and get into. A lot of fun stuff, you know. A lot of adventure. Fishing and hunting, bringing guns out, making tree houses and just wandering the fucking woods and whatever, you know. Being involved with the production of a farm, right? Doing the work at a farm. Once you get yourself acclimated to it, is a really good thing. And it's something that you look forward to. It's not work. It's not toil the way your work-a-day Joe job is, like mine, you know? Like, I hate coming to this fucking place, and I hate being here, and I hate the commute home, and I'm so glad when I get home that I don't even want to leave anymore. The work of a farm, the work of a ranch, doesn't suck the soul out of your being. It actually enhances it. It's a whole different thing, and it's very hard to explain. All you who have had a slice in your life of country living know what I'm talking about. It's a better way. But anyway, again, once again, away from the point. You got suburban kids, the boredom, the drugs, and throw in there the money, accessibility to money. The only thing they got to spend the money on is the drugs. So they not only do they get drugs, they get hard drugs, good drugs, and lots of them. The kids that didn't get involved with that stuff they are the kids who, like I brought up about the education system before as being like the big draw, right? A big draw for the families, these upper income families. Big draw is having a public school system that was rated very high. And that becomes the center of subdevelopment life, right? The school system. So if you happen to be an athlete or a scholar, you somehow have a tie-in to something going on extracurricular at the school through the year, there's probably enough to keep you occupied to the point where you don't necessarily fall to drugs, all right? So in terms of the boredom, the school is supposed to solve that. But what the school can't solve is your family situation, what's going on at home, right? But then, on top of all that, you have kids that, well, they're not into football, they're not into baseball, they're not into sports, they're not into chess club, they're not into playing a fucking trumpet in the marching band. They're not exactly academic whizzes. They're not going to take part in the science fair. They go to school. They meet girls. They socialize. They get the grades that they need to get to college, to get the job. And it's their life. But they don't have anything extracurricular. So now they're out of the school. So when there's downtime, there's boredom and nothing to resolve it, you know. Eventually, video games would come into prominence, and that's no way to waste your life. I mean, they existed. They were brand new. The Atari 2600, you know, at the onset of the expansion of subdevelopments in suburbia and Plano. Yeah, you had that. Video games prior to that weren't worth a damn. I mean, you spend 5 minutes playing them, and you were done. Pong and shit like that. It's boring, right? It was interesting that you could do something on your TV other than watch the television programs. You played a little game, and you just got sick of it. Once you got it kind of resolved, you were done. With Atari, the game types started to expand a little bit. You could endure playing it for more than 5 minutes. You could probably spend a good hour playing the games before you need to go do something else. And now, of course, the games have become completely all-encompassing, and you've got, like, rooms dedicated to playing them, and, you know, a kid, you could throw a box of pizza, a bag of fucking chips, and a bag of cookies down, get him a couple of fucking quarts of fucking Gatorade, stick it next to him. That kid could sit in a chair, play video games for 24 hours straight, no problem, you know. I plugged into headphones and microphones. But that doesn't really prevent the kid from turning to drugs. You know, that's kind of enhanced by drugs. And it's something that when you're on drugs, it's fun to do. Anyway, all this for nothing, right? I think what happens is there's a basic human need for adversity, and that's why these kids get into problems. There's nothing better to do on the one hand, but on the other hand, they need that something to do. There's an actual human need for adversity and challenges, and what happens is we get ourselves into this ideal circumstance, which seems to be like literally the American dream, right? A setup, an arrangement that's supposed to be perfect for a happy, healthy family. All the I's are dotted, all the T's are crossed, and there's really nothing left for the kid. We need our own adventure as people. And we need our own challenges, and we need our own adversity. And when we get plunked down into an idyllic situation, a living circumstance, where everything is basically taken care of and we are basically catered to, we do nothing but sit there and rot. We need the challenges. And I've had these thoughts, you know, as I've gotten older, looking back on my life, seeing where things took a turn from the worse. You know, gradually in my existence, you know, my father dragged the family out of Newark and close to his brother, right? That was his goal. And it became more of suburbs as we went, you know. The city living decreased the further west we went until we were plunked down in a subdevelopment and living a suburban life. And it was a graduation away from city life. And I keep thinking, you know, I kind of wish we would have just stayed the fucking Newark and figured it out. Dealt with the adversity that Newark as a city, as a dirty city, as a fucked up, corrupt city, all that had to offer. Deal with it. Stand up to the challenges. grow quicker, grow better, grow stronger, I think I would have been a better person for it all. There's always the risk that I would have got gunned down or I would have turned to drugs. Well, guess what? I turned to drugs anyway. And so did all these upper middle class kids in Plano. So you're escaping the city in part to get your kids away from that shit. And what do? They create an entire new culture of that shit in a different circumstance. You know what? It works for some people. It doesn't work for other people. The suburbs have trappings like that. And you got a boy who's an alpha male right out the gates. You're going to have to do something with his ambition. You couldn't keep me in the fucking neighborhood. You couldn't keep me in the subdevelopment. I was gone every day. You know? I had to go and find something and make something happen. I would literally walk 5 miles over the fucking mountain. Not uphill both ways. Well, yeah. No, not uphill both ways, but uphill one way. And then on the way back, up the other way. I walked to get the fuck out of that shit. And I labored to it, but I was going after sex, drugs, and rock and roll. No different. But I wasn't staying at home. And it's whatever. I think I'm talking about good things, but I think I'm saying it in a poor way. And I think I'm losing interest. I want to get to what I want to get to. I got to step it up a little bit here. We have a basic human need for adversity. And when we don't have it, we start to create our own problems. We become drama people, right? We create drama for ourselves out of boredom just to kind of shake things up a little bit. And I remember having those exact thoughts as a teenager, you know, being so bored. It's like, well, let's just break something. You know, like go vandalize. Go steal something. Shit that you didn't have to do. Shit that you didn't want to do, but you just had to do some fucking thing to just shake it up a bit, right? So we create our own problems, create this drama. And, you know, that's my vision of what suburbia is, you know. It's good for many and it's horrible for many. I think at the heart of it, you know, if you want it to be good for your kids, you have to have a good marriage. That's the key right there. You can't fuck with that. The marriage has to be golden. It has to be high priority, top priority. You have to make sacrifices to make the marriage be... as perfect as one can be. And if that means quitting your job, selling the house and downsizing, then that's what it means. That's what it means. Obviously, if it means not having that affair with that 20-something fucking up-and-coming office whore, that's what it means. If it means going back to the fucking city that you fled, that's what it means. But without your strong marriage as a foundation for the rest of the family situation, you don't have a fucking family. You have a broken family waiting to happen. It's broken before it breaks, believe me. That's my experience. I grew up with a mother and father all the way until I became a young adult. They stayed in the same house together in spite of their derision toward one another. They, quote unquote, did it for the kids. What the fuck did they do for the kids? We were both on drugs. And I was a fucking head case. Not my brother, not a head case. I was a fucking head case. There was obviously problems. And them being together weren't solving that. They should have split apart. It would have been better for everybody, right? But it should never come to that. The marriage matters. You can't do this suburban thing with a bad marriage. And you can't do a marriage when you're compromising it with your work situation. It can be a catch-22 for some people. If you're not ready for the suburbs, don't go. It's that simple. If your job doesn't allow for that lifestyle, if you have to work 16 hours a day to make the money you need to live out in these fucking places, it ain't worth it. Your quality of life sucks, and you're going to look for diversions. And when you fuck up, you don't fuck it up just for yourself, and you don't fuck it up just for your marriage, you fuck up your kids' lives in ways that nobody can even see. You can't see it, the woman, your wife can't see it, the kids themselves, even if they know what's going on, they don't understand the damage that's being done inside of them. All my friends were fucking in divorced households. All the burnouts, you know? We all had all kinds of issues involving abuse and stuff like that. But one thing for certain, all those families were broken. Even the ones that, the few that actually had a mother and father in the house, they didn't get along. They were doing, I had friends, I hate to talk about people, but I had a good friend of mine, right? Good friend of mine, mother and father in the house, they both had their own boyfriends and girlfriends that they would go. And it was like a known thing. It's just like, yeah, that's it. Dad's got his girlfriend over there. She comes by every once, like, you know, no secret. It was just on a table. It's just a way of life. That's how they lived. You don't think that like does some shit to you? And that becomes your idea of normal. I mean, how does that play out in your in the kids' adulthood? Whatever. All kinds of shit can happen. People are different. But what suburbia looks like. So now we got suburbia, right? After all that, we've invented the car. We paved up some fucking roadways. We built up these sub-developments. We got suburbia. So what next? What comes after this? Is there going to ever be a new way of living, right? You had the urban lifestyle and the rural, and that goes all the way back to fucking Methuselah, right? And then eventually, here in the wonderful United States of America, we came up with this third alternative of a way of living called suburban living. Is there some fourth way out there? You know, a new way, a fourth way? And I think of future thinking. Old assholes like I am revert back to entertainment that triggered your ideas of what the future may be like, right? Science fiction, movies and TV shows like Star Trek, I brought up at length before, right? Star Wars, Space 1999, that was fucking terrible. I don't get into that. All these different things. But, you know, there was a cartoon that actually came out like way early in the 60s, but it played in syndication forever and ever and ever. I grew up with it as well as so many other things, but it was called the Jetsons, right? Whole futuristic thing, right? I talked about how the automobile paved the way for suburbia to actually occur here, right? So just one invention made this whole way of life possible. Could there be another invention, even another vehicle that makes another way of life possible, right? Like in the Jetsons, let me tell you about the Jetsons right quick. I put a little something aside here to describe the Jetsons in some detail for you youngins and for you future people out there, right? Here we go. The Jetsons is an American animated sitcom produced by Hanna-Barbera Productions. It originally aired in prime time from September 23rd, 1962 to March 17th, 1963 on ABC, Television Network. Then it later aired in reruns via syndication, and they even did some new episodes. I didn't even know this. Produced from 1985 to 1987, right? Because I wasn't really watching cartoons when I graduated from high school and went into the Marine Corps. What else could be said about it? It was Hanna-Barbera's space-age counterpart to another cartoon called The Flintstones, which was kind of the prehistoric Stone Age take on the old 50s TV show The Honeymooners, right? While The Flintstones lived in a world which was a comical version of the Stone Age, with machines powered by birds and dinosaurs, the Jetsons lived in a comical version of a century in the future, with elaborate robotic contraptions, aliens, holograms, and whimsical inventions. Right? So it's a futuristic cartoon that came out in the 1960s, but they had kind of what I'm alluding to, a potential new vehicle that could potentially create a new way of life that looks like whoever the creators of that particular animated series saw things potentially to be, right? They had, the Jetsons had the Aero car, A-E-R-O car, like Aerosmith, Aero car, right? The Aero car, it didn't drive with wheels on rubber tires on the roads, right? Like the suburbs didn't need just the vehicle. The suburbs also needed the highways, the roads, in order for the suburbs to be feasible, be viable. But the Aero car don't need roads. Ah, right. It flies in the air. It's little miniature airplanes. But they're, you know, like family size, automobile size. And the way they lived, and I don't know how it was, but they lived on like these massive stilts in these apartment complexes, these buildings that were way up in the sky. Right, so they lived up like up in the fucking clouds somewhere, and every one of these domestic structures, you just boop, 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 in your Aero car between, right? Could something like that possibly be in our future, or something else? Well, yeah, the possibility is always there. I wonder, will we ever really get to this fourth way of living, and maybe, get rid of the fucking suburbs that are so useless. Urban life has proved itself out over the millennia, and rural life has proved itself out over the millennia. But this suburban life, I think, is still kind of experimental. And I think it's failing, personally. That's my opinion of it. You may differ. You're allowed to differ. That's okay. We could still be friends about it, I think. Maybe, possibly. It's up to you. I wonder, if humanity, right, will truly progress with ingenuity. What do I mean by that? I mean truly progress. We talk about progress, right? And a lot of us like progressive people, progressive politics, right? Progress is really all progress, everything going forward, It's going away from the traditional ways of things, and that includes technology, and that includes civil concerns, right? The social concerns. We progress, right? Socially, the progress is like civil rights in America, for example, or wherever else that they're going to have or will apply in the world. Right, civil rights is just kind of like making sure that every citizen is kind of on equal footing, right? That tends to be, politically speaking, the focus of quote unquote progress. And as we have progressed technologically through these past 100 years rapidly, what has become of our social progress outside of things like civil rights? To an individual, are we better people? Am I a better person than, say, my grandfather or great-grandfather was? Am I a stronger person? And I mentioned earlier about, 13 years old now, 15 years old now, you're a fucking child. 100 years ago, at the age of 15, you were an adult. You were married, you were having kids, you were working. That, to me, is degeneration, right? That is a decline in society. Every generation that goes by, it seems like it's another 5 years extra required for them to mature into adults fully, right? You know, when I was a kid, I'd have to say you were basically a kid till about the age of 21. I mean, technically it was 18, but really we weren't really beginning to grow up and take on adult situations until 21, because a lot of us were going to college, right? And we weren't getting married. That's really where it starts. There's that M word again. You know, when people start deciding that they're in love and they're going to get married and settle down and have kids, you know, you start doing that. In my generation, that seemed to start happening 20, 21, 22, around then. That's the age I was when I first got married, right? You know, some may be 18, some may be 25, but it kind of averages down into the early 20s somewhere. And now you got people, they're still living in their parents' their single parents' basement, and to the fucking age of like 38. They stay in college. If they go to school, they stay in college. They get their master's, and they stay in college until they're 30-something like that. They take 2 years to decide what they want to do as a job. And they get a job, they're working at home out of their mother's basement. It's just whatever. I'm ragging on people. Maybe I'm a little jealous. I don't know. But what I'm trying to express is a degeneracy in our society over the generations, where we are a lot slower now to mature in general than we used to be. There are obviously exceptions to the rule. I think both of my wife's young men, her children, my stepsons, and I have no or very little impact on the men they've become, because I came very late in the game. Too late for one of them and very late for the other one. I said they're both in the military, and I think they're both very mature, very much so compared to just about any other young person who I find out there in and around their age. Right? It ain't even close. They're very respectable. Very respectable young men, as far as I'm concerned. But what I'm talking about here, will humanity as a whole progress with ingenuity? And I think the potential is there. What I mean to say, will we evolve into like a Jetsons kind of future? Will we evolve alongside our technological advancement? Will we become better people as a result of our ingenuity and our creativity and our inventions? I think that's natural to happen. And I think for it not to happen, it has to be done with intent. Somebody's got to fight up against it. And I think that element exists. And I think that's what we're dealing with in the world right now, right? Will humanity truly progress with ingenuity, or will the sociopath, elite, Western globalist eugenicists exterminate 3/4 of the entire population of mankind and jam the rest of us into the 15-minute post-industrial dystopian cities tied to a tiny apartment by a government umbilical cord that meets out our limited supply of adequate nutrients and necessary dosages of whatever fucking drugs it is that we need to persist in those very restricted conditions, right? I talk about this American dream, and I think we need a new American dream. And I think we need a new American reality.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Stalin Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.